so I can drive this car. Wait here and I'll back it out. It was obvious from the cautious way Mrs. Whitworth handled the car that she was still a novice driver and a little nervous about backing up. She got out, giving the car a rueful glance. "The poor thing looks odd without that door," she said. "I really don't know why they make doors like that. They're dangerous." Camera in hand, Lizzie agreed. "Mr. Mosley says that those rear-swinging doors are called suicide doors. If the inside handle is accidentally flipped, the door can be ripped open by the wind, and the passenger, or the driver, tumbles out," Mrs. Whitworth said. "Exactly," Lizzie said. At the front of the car, she bent over to examine the bumper and grill, as Mr. Mosley had asked. But as far as she could tell, the chrome-plated trim was brand new. It wasn't scratched. It wasn't even muddy. And the sheriff would have to notice that there was no mud elsewhere on the car, as there surely would have been if it had been driven on the Jericho Road after the recent rains. Lizzie aimed the Brownie at the bumper and grill and took several photographs, watching the numbers in the camera's little window and being careful to advance the film each time. Then she took a picture of each front fender and, for good measure, the missing door, 8 altogether. "Well, that's that," she said when she had finished the roll. "Thank you for letting me do this. I'm sure Mr. Mosley will be relieved to know that you weren't terribly injured when you fell out of the car, and that he won't likely have to defend you in court," she thought. Mrs. Whitworth looked penitent. "Please thank him for me, Miss Lacey. And I would appreciate it if you didn't mention that I thought of letting him go. It feels very good to know he's looking out for me. And you've been helpful, too." She frowned apprehensively. "You don't really think the sheriff is going to..." Her voice trailed off. "I think you should be prepared for that," Lizzie said. She made her voice sound confident. "But as far as I can see, there's nothing here that would suggest that your car was involved in your husband's accident." She thought of something she had heard Mr. Mosley say on occasion and went on. "Still, it would be a good idea if you didn't see or talk to Mr. Harwood until after the sheriff has finished his investigation. That might just complicate things." Mrs. Whitworth's face fell, and Lizzie suspected that she had been planning to see him that night, or at least talk to him on the phone. "Do you really feel that's necessary?" Mrs. Whitworth asked plaintively. "I'm afraid I do." Reassuringly, Lizzie added, "But just as a precaution, and only until the sheriff figures out what really happened last night, I don't think you have anything terribly serious to worry about." "I hope not," Mrs. Whitworth said fervently, wrapping her arms around herself. "It's bad enough to have to deal with my husband's death. Being accused of causing it would be just too much." Lizzie liked Mrs. Whitworth and found herself hoping so, too. When she called Mr. Mosley to report what she had seen and heard, that's what she told him. "I don't believe she'll have a problem with the sheriff," she said. She wondered whether she should tell him about the odd remark about her grandmother making her marry Mr. Whitworth. But maybe it wasn't so odd after all. The Vautiers had been an old, traditional family, and Regina's grandmother was the matriarch. Perhaps she had realized that she was nearing the end of her life and felt she needed to find a husband for her young granddaughter. "Unless, of course," Mr. Mosley put in cautiously, "there's something she's not telling us." His voice darkened. "And this business with Frank Harwood bothers me, Liz. I'll be back in town about 11 tomorrow. I'll drop in at the Dodge dealership and have a little talk with Harwood. I want to hear his side of the story." Lizzie felt relieved. She'd been half afraid Mr. Mosley was going to send her to interview Frank Harwood, and her evening was already spoken for. Freeman and Sally Lou were coming over. Chapter 20. Liz Has Visitors. Daffodil, Lizzie's orange tabby cat, was waiting on the porch swing when she walked up the 4 front steps to her butter-yellow house. He jumped down and followed her as she unlocked her front door, recently painted a playful green, and went inside, feeling the quiet pleasure that always settled over her as she stepped into the front hall. She took off her sweater and hung it on one of the brass-plated hooks where she kept her straw garden hat and her raincoat and umbrella. Daffy rubbed her ankles, purring, and she bent over to pet him, then let him lead her into the kitchen. There, as he did every day, he supervised her preparation of his supper. Daffy was especially fond of a bit of mashed cooked chicken livers served with his tuna fish. Lizzie always asked Mrs. Hancock to save her some when fresh chickens arrived at the grocery. At 5 cents a pound, livers were cheaper than tuna, which had recently gone from 8 to 10 cents for a small can. While Daffy was enjoying his feast, Lizzie hurried upstairs to change into comfortable slacks and her favorite green plaid blouse, then went out to the chicken coop to gather the day's eggs. There were 8 jumbo-sized brown eggs in the nests, contributed by her mixed flock of Rhode Island Reds, Barred Rocks, and a white Leghorn. She paused to stroke Caruso, her mild-mannered Buff Orpington rooster, who joined the other neighborhood roosters in a daily dawn chorus. On Lizzie's block, it was impossible to sleep past sunrise. Heading back to the house, she stopped in the kitchen garden to pick a large ripe tomato and the last green bell pepper grown from seed Bessie Bloodworth had given her. In the kitchen, she sliced the tomato and pepper and whipped up an omelet with 2 of the fresh eggs, along with a bit of leftover ham and some onions. She added several soda crackers and a helping of cottage cheese to her plate, poured a glass of cold apple cider, and sat down to her supper, feeling extraordinarily lucky and rich. She wasn't rich, of course. Nobody was rich these days, with the Depression howling at the door like a hungry wolf, and she was increasingly anxious about the situation in Mr. Mosley's office. But if she set aside the fear of getting her hours cut back, she had everything she needed to keep her comfortable and content. She had friends, especially the Dahlias, and her pretty house and garden and chickens and her real work, her writing. Even if she had to find another job, she would be content, wouldn't she? And being content was better than being rich. But there was Grady, and the unresolved question brought her a tiny nibble of something like, was it guilt? Yes, she was enjoying her life and was contented with what she had, but was it selfish to be focused so entirely on herself, on what she wanted to do with her time, with her days and nights, with her life? Her mother thought so, and seized every opportunity to remind her that it was a woman's job to create a comfortable home, please a husband, and take care of the children. Grady thought so, too. He had never made any secret of his opinion. She certainly understood his point of view and could even sympathize, especially now that he had to think about little Grady, about making a life, and finding a mother for his motherless son. A man couldn't raise a child by himself. Well, she supposed that it might be possible, but she had never known one who had tried. She got up and carried her supper dishes to the sink, frowning. Why was it so hard to imagine herself as Mrs. Grady Alexander? She had loved Grady once, not passionately, perhaps, but warmly. She was sure it would be easy to love him again. Her heart had been touched by his pain and his need and by his desire to pull her back into his life. She knew she could count on him to love enough for the both of them. There was something else, too. Something that hadn't occurred to her until just that moment. Mr. Mosley spent more and more time in Montgomery these days. Was he keeping her on at the office just to give her a job? Perhaps he would be glad if she announced that she was planning to quit and get married. Grady had a good, secure job that paid enough to support a family, especially if they lived in his house and found somebody to rent hers. And surely she could find a couple of hours in the day— perhaps when little Grady was napping, when she could sit down at her typewriter. When she thought of the possibility of losing her job, the idea of marrying Grady seemed more attractive, although the thought of somebody else living in her beautiful little house was an unpleasant taste in her mouth. She rinsed off her supper dishes, left them on the sink to dry, and went back down the hall. On her right, polished wooden stairs led up to the two small bedrooms with steeply slanted ceilings and gable windows. In the front bedroom, her bureau and dressing table, and a single bed covered with a home-crafted pink and yellow quilt and yellow ruffled pillows with a window overlooking the shady front yard and the oak-lined street. In the back bedroom, a work table, a chair, a bookcase, her typewriter, and a window overlooking the backyard and garden. Under the window were shelves that held her quilting fabrics and tools and baskets of knitting yarn. She hesitated, thinking that she might go upstairs and put in an hour's work on the manuscript before Sally Lou and Freeman arrived, but she didn't like to get started when she couldn't devote several hours to the task, so she went into the parlor to make sure it was ready for company. Like the two rooms upstairs, it was small, with just enough space for a mission-style leather sofa, the old armchair she had reupholstered in brown corduroy, a Tiffany-style lamp with a stained-glass lampshade, and bookshelves on both sides of the small brick fireplace. She turned on the lamp, plumped the cushions, and brushed a bit of Daffy's orange fur off the armchair, where he liked to lie and keep an eye on her as she knitted or read the newspaper. A copy of the weekend's Mobile Press Register was lying on the floor with the headline, "Woman Kidnapped Victim Feared Dead," staring up at her. This one was a wealthy young socialite from Louisville, Kentucky. Her family had already paid $50,000, and the victim had not yet been returned. Lizzie picked up the newspaper and was folding it when she heard the front doorbell ring, just once, briefly and authoritatively. Startled, she glanced at the banjo clock on the fireplace mantel. It was much too early for Sally Lou and Freeman, and they were coming to the back door. It wouldn't be Grady, either. He'd had a funny shave-and-a-haircut-two-bits knock that always set the two of them laughing, unless he'd decided that things had changed and the knock was no longer appropriate. Or it might be her mother coming across the street, loaded with a barrage of complaints about Mr. Dunlap's encounter with Deputy Springer. Guiltily remembering their phone conversation that afternoon, sometimes she really wasn't a very good daughter. Lizzie stuck the newspaper under her arm and hurried to the door. But it wasn't her mother. It wasn't Grady, either. On the other side of the screen door stood a man in a slim-fitting gray three-piece business suit, a crisply pressed white shirt, a steel-blue tie the color of his eyes, and a gray fedora with a rakish tilt. He was tall, well over 6 feet, and well-built, and he held himself with the easy confidence of an athlete. He wasn't handsome. His features, a hard mouth, high cheekbones, pale eyes, were too rugged for that. Behind him, parked on the street, was a racy-looking blue roadster with the top folded down. "Miss Lacey?" He took off his hat. Sun-bleached hair fell across his tanned forehead. His voice was firm and clipped, a business-like Yankee voice. "Elizabeth Lacey?" "Yes," Lizzie said, hesitantly. Her first panicky thought was to slam the door and lock it, but reason quickly prevailed. A kidnapper wouldn't be driving a roadster with the top down, and while he looked strong enough to make off with her under one arm, she doubted that kidnappers went around in a dapper-looking suit and tie. Anyway, it was still daylight, and old Mr. Perkins was sitting on his porch on the other side of the street, watching. But just out of caution, she waved and smiled at Mr. Perkins, letting the man know they were being watched. "I'm sorry," she said, directing her attention back to the man. "Who did you say?" He held up his wallet and displayed an identification card. "My name is Ryan Nichols. I'm with the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, in Washington, D.C. He quirked an eyebrow. "You've read about us in the newspapers?" Lizzie leaned forward and looked at the card. There was his photograph, his name, and the rest of it. "Yes, of course, I've read about the WPA," she said. The Works Progress Administration was an ambitious companion to the popular Civilian Conservation Corps, which it constructed and was managing the CCC camp a few miles outside of town. The WPA employed workers to build public roads and highways, construct dams and airfields, and erect public buildings all over the country. Established by President Roosevelt and run by FDR's right-hand man, Harry Hopkins, the WPA was the government's answer to the hated dole. People didn't want relief. They wanted to work. They wanted to earn their money rather than take a government handout. The WPA was already helping nearly 2 million unemployed men find work that would enable them and their families to survive these lean years. "I know about the WPA," she repeated. "But I don't know what the WPA wants with me. I have a job." At least I have a job right now, she thought, although that could change at any moment. She added dryly, "And I'm a woman." Ouch. There was that quirky eyebrow again, and a quick, disarming grin that eased the lines of his craggy face. Lizzie thought suddenly that he looked as if he'd be more at home in a flannel shirt, blue jeans and work boots than in that three-piece suit. Nichols folded his wallet and put it back in his pocket. "You've got a point, Miss Lacey, unfortunately. So far, the WPA's projects have been mostly heavy construction, buildings, roads, airfields, docks. We employ mostly men, but that's about to change. The WPA is in the process of creating a new federal project that will support writers, editors, historians, teachers, and librarians, many of them, maybe most of them, women. They'll be compiling and writing tourist guides for every one of the 48 states, collecting local history and folklore, doing social research, that sort of thing. They're going to need program directors and administrators to manage their assignments. Those people will likely be women, too.
Well, that's good news, Lizzie said decidedly.
There are plenty of women who need work.
But I don't understand why.
The project hasn't been funded yet, Nichols went on. But when it's up and running early next year, it will be a part of a group of New Deal arts programs known as Federal Project Number One. I'll be in charge of the Southern Region based in Montgomery.
He tilted his head, regarding her.
You've been recommended to me, and I'd like to tell you more about the project. May I come in?
I was recommended to you?
Lizzie was astonished.
But I don't know anybody in Washington. Who in the world?
You know people in New York. In fact, I think it's fair to say that they're big fans of yours.
Lizzie shook her head. I don't... She paused. I think you must be mistaken, Mr. Nichols. The only people I know in New York are my agent and my editor, and I've never met them, except through the mail.
But they know you, Nichols grinned. It happens that I was in the city last week, and both Nadine Fleming, your agent, and your editor, Max Perkins, spoke to me about you. They told me that you have a book coming out with Scribner's in a few months. Historical fiction, Max Perkins said, about the Civil War. Both he and Miss Fleming seem to think that you know quite a lot about this area and the people here, and that you're the kind of person who could help us with this important project.
Lizzie's apprehensions eased somewhat, even though the man was still very large and almost, but not quite, physically intimidating. But she couldn't turn away a friend of Miss Fleming and Mr. Perkins, even if he was a Yankee. She opened the screen door.
Well, I suppose you should come in then, Mr. Nichols, she added. I'm expecting someone in a little while, but perhaps you'd like a cup of coffee.
I would, Nichols said, stepping inside. I had a swell supper of meatloaf and mashed potatoes and gravy at the diner, good down-home food. Another cup of coffee would hit the spot, and I promise not to take up too much of your time.
Ryan Nichols looked no smaller sitting down. For the next 20 minutes, he occupied a good half of Lizzie's small parlor sofa. Over coffee and a plate of chocolate crunch cookies, he talked with energy and excitement about Project One. When it was in full operation, he said, it would eventually employ some 6,000 workers, three-quarters of them women, across the United States. Field workers, most of whom would have done white-collar work, would be drawn from the local unemployment lists. They would be trained and managed by an editorial staff, people, again, mostly women, with experience in writing and management. For the editorial staff, there would likely be some regional travel, overseeing field workers and attending meetings with other managers. Nichols leaned forward, gesturing, his face animated, its lines eased.
Our biggest goal, of course, is to put people to work, get them a job, put money in their pockets, give them a future to hope for. But we're also expected to produce useful projects that will help local communities and states. Not buildings or roads, but a better understanding of their local landscape, a clearer sense of local history.
Mr. Nichols, Lizzie said carefully, here in Darling, we are steeped in history. Sometimes I think we are drowning in it. This is the South, you know, the Confederate South.
Yes, of course it is, and that's why it's important.
He set his coffee cup down and reached for another cookie.
Once this project is up and running, we'll be collecting oral histories from citizens who haven't yet told their stories, older citizens especially, who remember what life was like in the old days, before our modern times. People whose parents and grandparents settled in area, immigrants from foreign countries, colored citizens too, some of whom may have slave stories to tell.
Slave stories? Uh-oh, Lizzie thought wryly. This Yankee doesn't know what he's getting into. But she only said,
well, there are plenty of those stories around here.
We're also hearing from the folklorists, he added. Some of them are interested in documenting local folklore. He popped the rest of the cookie into his mouth.
Say, this is good.
That one happens to be a Yankee recipe, Lizzie said with amusement. But we have plenty of wonderful Southern cooks here. Maybe the government would be interested in compiling a book of Alabama recipes.
He regarded her with mock sternness. Don't laugh, Miss Lacey. That might just happen.
Food and drink can tell the history of an area, can't it? I'm sure the food here in Darling is part of Darling's story.
Suppressing a chuckle, Lizzie thought of the secret ingredient in Aunt Hetty's pecan pie and wondered what Mr. Nichols would say if she told him about it. But he was going on.
Federal One will also include projects on music, theater and art, and handicrafts. Just last week, I met Harriet Clinton, who directs our WPA program in Milwaukee. She's planning a work project that will employ women to make and sell toys, dolls, furniture. They're even setting up a weaving studio to make rugs. She says it's a way to preserve traditional crafts while creating jobs for people, for women, mostly.
He grinned.
You can bet that Mrs. Roosevelt is interested in that one. In fact, she's behind the whole thing.
There was a current of excitement in Ryan Nichols' voice, and Lizzie found herself studying him closely. He was a Yankee, which certainly made him different from the other men she knew. He was also very good-looking, with an easy manner that was at once friendly, engaging, and confident. And he was clearly enthusiastic about what the federal government was doing, creating jobs for people who needed them, jobs that would put money in their pockets and raise their sense of self-worth. What's more, he obviously believed that this was the right thing for the government to be doing in the current desperate situation. There were people who didn't like the idea of the government making work for people, but Lizzie wasn't one of them. Over the last year, she had seen how Darling had been helped by the CCC camp. The boys from Camp Briarwood spent their pocket money in Darling stores, and people in Darling who worked at the camp or sold their farm produce to the camp spent their money in town, too. Darling was more prosperous, and Darling folk were beginning to feel better. She wanted to believe that the federal arts program would have a similar impact.
As I said, we don't have the funding right now, Nichols went on. But we're asking for $5 billion, with the money to come as soon as we get congressional approval. FDR is a man in a hurry, as you probably know. He's told us that he wants us to be ready to hit the ground running as soon as the money is available. I'm starting now. I'm lining up people who might be available to work as program administrators, full or part-time. He gave her a serious look. I know it's too soon to ask for a commitment, Miss Lacey. And I understand that you're currently employed. But people's situations change, especially these days. And if the position is out of the question for you, perhaps you can recommend someone local, who might be available. And then, suddenly, it all came together for Lizzie. She had been fortunate so far, but times were hard right now, and she couldn't count on keeping her full-time job with Mr. Mosley. Perhaps she wouldn't even have a part-time job. And while she might very well decide that she loved Grady, it would be wrong to marry him just because she had lost her job and he still had his. Really, she ought to be ashamed of herself for even thinking of it. This proposal from Mr. Nichols, it was like a bolt out of the blue, and a very lucky bolt at that. It might be exactly what she needed at exactly the right time. She leaned back in her chair and spoke as evenly as she could. To tell the truth, Mr. Nichols, things are a little rough in the office right now. I work for a lawyer here in town, and the people who need him can't afford to pay him. He's been talking about reducing my hours. If things don't improve, I'm afraid he might have to let me go altogether. The words were a hard slice at her heart. But hearing them, she felt suddenly, surprisingly, relieved. Spoken out loud, in that even, factual tone of voice, they didn't seem nearly as menacing as they had when they were screaming in the dark corners of her mind. "I'm sorry," Mr. Nichols said gravely. "Unfortunately, I've been hearing that all too often. And I felt the pinch myself. It's hard to make plans when you can't see past the end of the week." He gave her a crooked smile. "But if you're facing the layoff, or worse, maybe I came along at the right time." She managed a half-smile in return. "Maybe so. Anyway, please do put my name on your list, and when you're ready to get started, let me know. If I can help, I will." She gave him the office number, and her home number, too, and added ruefully, "If you can't reach me at the law office, it probably means I don't work there any longer, or that my hours have been reduced. I'll be here at home, working on my book." Mr. Nichols wrote down her numbers on a card. "Thanks," he said. "I'm grateful to Miss Fleming for giving me your name, and to you for giving me your time tonight, and coffee and cookies, too. Even a Yankee cookie." There was that grin again. "You'll be hearing from me as soon as I have news." He slipped the card into his suit jacket pocket, then paused and took something out. "Hey, I almost forgot. When I got out of the car out in front of your house, I happened to look down and noticed this. It was growing in your yard, so it belongs to you. But since I'm the one who found it, maybe it means good luck for both of us." He was holding out a four-leaf clover. When Mr. Nichols had gone, Lizzie took their coffee cups to the kitchen, where she refilled the plate of cookies. She had just set the plate on the kitchen table when there was a soft knock at the kitchen door. It was Sally Lou, with Freeman behind her. Sally Lou was wearing a dark cotton skirt and blouse and a dark brown sweater, clutched around her against the October night chill. Freeman was dressed in bib overalls and a blue cotton work shirt and a striped denim railroad cap. "Hi, Sally Lou," Lizzie said, smiling. "Gosh, Freeman, it's good to see you again." Freeman looked down at her. When they were kids, she'd be the tall one. He was taller than she by a full head now, and broad-shouldered rather than skinny. But he still had that quick, shy grin. "Same here, Miss Lizzie. You still go fishing down at Spook Creek?" No, but I remember when we used to do that on hot summer days. Lizzie matched his grin. You still have Myrtle the turtle?
He shook his head.
Nope. Took her out to the swamp and turned her loose so she could find some friends. But my kids got a goat named General Grant. They go fishing at Spook Creek every chance they get.
Lizzie laughed. I guess kids don't change much, do they? Shall we take our coffee and go into the parlor? She gestured toward the plate of cookies. We have something to munch on, too.
Sally Lou frowned.
We ain't staying long, you know. This ain't exactly a parlor call.
She pointed to the table.
Y'all can sit right here and have your talk. I'll go out on the porch.
Spoken like a big sister, Lizzie said.
Yeah, Freeman said, sounding disgruntled. Sally Lou, she just can't stop ordering people around. Come here, go there, get those chores done.
He pulled out a chair and sat down.
But this here's good enough for me, and if I know Sally Lou, she'll put her ear to the door if she goes out on the poach. Far as I'm concerned, she can sit right here and listen.
He gave his sister a pointed look.
Long as she don't talk too much or try to act like she's smarter than us.
He turned the look on Lizzie.
And long as somebody tells me how come I'm here.
Sally Lou sat down too, and Lizzie poured coffee.
Sally Lou didn't tell you?
Uh-uh, Freeman said, shaking his head. She just told me I gotta come see you.
Lizzie reached into the pocket of her slacks and took out Desiree's penciled note. Tell Sally Lou you need to talk to Freeman right away. Tell him I told you to ask him what he saw last night, and don't take no for an answer. She handed the wrinkled paper to Freeman.
I was at the Whitworth house this morning, and Desiree slipped me this note. Do you know what it means?
Freeman read it silently, pushing his lips in and out.
Don't take no for an answer, huh? He scowled. Means you all are fixing to get me in trouble.
Sally Lou frowned.
You got to tell what you seen, Freeman, she said firmly. If you didn't do nothing wrong, you won't get in trouble. Oh, yeah?
Freeman was caustic.
Lots you know about it, sister.
Lizzie pushed the plate of cookies across the table.
Does it have something to do with Mr. Whitworth's accident?
Freeman took a cookie.
Less said the better, he muttered. Freeman.
Sally Lou narrowed her eyes.
What you know you gotta tell, so get to it.
Freeman looked at his sister as if he were measuring her authority. Finally, reluctantly, he gave in.
Well, for starters, wasn't no accident. Doobie and me, we was there, we seen it.
Doobie? Lizzie asked. Who's he?
A no-count scallywag is what he is,
Sally Lou muttered, taking a cookie. Freeman frowned at his sister. To Lizzie, he said,
Doobie Jenkins. We go fishing together some Sundays. He worked some for Mrs. Forenberry tidying up her garden. He had to run an errand over to the Whitworth's house this morning. We'd agreed we wasn't going to tell, but I reckon he could have said something to Desiree. She got a nose about as long as a rake handle.
He sounded disgruntled.
Doobie, he likes to brag on himself. Should have known I couldn't trust him to keep his gall-dern trap shut.
Sally Lou scowled.
Freeman, I want you to stop talking about Doobie. Tell what you saw, straight out, right now. And we don't need none of your cursing, you hear?
Freeman put both hands flat on the table, and for a moment, Lizzie thought he was going to get up and march out. But Sally Lou had practically raised her younger brother, and her old command over him was too strong. He sighed, sat back in his chair, and gave in. With an obvious reluctance, he began his story. He and Doobie Jenkins had spent Sunday afternoon and evening fishing underneath the railroad bridge over Spook Creek. The fish were biting. Each of them had a hefty string of catfish and stripers, and they hated to leave. But it would be dark soon, and they were on foot, so they thought they'd better head back to town. They were halfway up Spook Hill when they saw Mr. Whitworth's Pierce Arrow coming over the top.
He is coming right smart, Freeman said. And the road is kind of narrow right there.
So he and Doobie jumped the ditch on the uphill side and climbed a little way into some trees. They were waiting to let him pass when they saw another car, a black Ford, coming down the hill behind him, fast. The Pierce Arrow was halfway down the hill when the other car rammed it in the rear.
Pow!
Freeman said, smacking his right fist into the flat of his left palm.
Just like that. And then pow! Damn fool revved his engine and did it again.
He slid a glance at Sally Lou, who was narrowing her eyes at him.
Sorry, he muttered.
Wait. Startled, Lizzie held up her hand. You say the Ford hit Mr. Whitworth's car twice? On purpose?
On purpose? Sally Lou echoed. Lordy me! Yes, on purpose.
Freeman's face was grim.
That hill was muddy, and once could have been an accident, not twice. Made two big loud clangs like a freight car coupling. Doobie and me, we about jumped out of our skins.
And then what? Lizzie asked.
And then that old Pierce Arrow, it sailed down the hill like a big bird and flipped off the road at the bottom.
Freeman illustrated a somersault with his hands,
and then went flying down that big, steep bank.
And the car that hit him? The Ford? What did the driver do? Lizzie asked excitedly. Did he stop? Did he get out?
Nope.
Freeman shook his head.
He speeded up and just kept on going down the road. Didn't get out, didn't even stop. Just kept on driving like nothing had happened.
He left the scene, Lizzie murmured. Even if it couldn't be proved that he deliberately caused the accident, it was a crime to drive away. One of Mr. Mosley's clients had gotten into some pretty serious trouble doing just that.
Lord sakes, Freeman, Sally Lou said, leaning forward. So that bad man just up and drove off? What'd you and Doobie do?
Us?
Why, we dropped our fish and our poles and we run fast as our legs would carry us down the hill to see if we could do anything for poor old Mr. Whitworth. But the good Lord done took him, or the devil won.
Freeman's eyes went to Sally Lou as if he was expecting her to correct him. When she didn't, he went on.
I'm here to tell you there was no way on God's little green earth that me and Doobie could have got that car back on its wheels, the two of us. And even if we could have, there was nothing at all we could do for that man. He was squashed flat as a bug under that car. He was dead.
Sally Lou regarded her brother fixedly.
So then what did you do?
Freeman looked away, unwilling to meet her eyes.
Me and Doobie? He said innocently. Why, we picked up our poles and our fish and we hot-footed it back on home fast as we could.
Lizzie frowned. You didn't call the sheriff?
No, of course he didn't. That's why nobody knew what had happened until well into the next morning when the wreck was discovered. Don't got no phone,
Freeman muttered. Sally Lou's voice oozed sarcasm.
You two grown-up men couldn't find a phone or walk across the courthouse lawn to the sheriff's office and tell him face-to-face what you seen?
I guess maybe we could have.
Freeman twisted his mouth.
But you got to take the whole situation into account, Sally Lou. Doobie's been arrested twice, see? He's scared of the law, and we...
He ducked his head.
Well... We had us a bottle of shine down there under the bridge, and... So you was drunk.
Sally Lou's tone was withering.
Not very, Freeman protested. Not by that time, anyway.
He turned to Lizzie, his hands out.
Miss Liz, I swear, I was sober enough to see what happened, and so was Doobie. We just wasn't sober enough to tell it to the sheriff. At least, that's how Doobie saw it. He made me promise. Sure he did, Sally Lou growled. And then he done went and told it hisself to Desiree, so you can forget that promise.
Doggedly, Freeman shook his head.
Sis, I give Doobie my word that I...
Freeman, Lizzie said, You witnessed a crime. Not an accident, a crime. If the person who did it isn't caught and punished, he could do it again. A man is dead. It's your duty to help Sheriff Norris get to the bottom of it. She could see the dogged expression on Freeman's face, but she took a breath and plunged ahead. The car that hit Mr. Whitworth's car, did you recognize it? Freeman hesitated. His eyes were half shut and he was pushing his lips in and out. He wasn't looking at Sally Lou, but that didn't stop her.
If you know that car, Freeman, she said grimly, you gotta tell. You got no choice.
Freeman laced his fingers around his coffee cup.
You hear me, little brother?
Sally Lou raised her voice, and Lizzie recognized the tone. She had heard it often enough herself when she was a girl. Sally Lou wasn't a big person, but she had a big voice and a way of making you do the right thing, whether you wanted to do it or not. Freeman pulled at his bottom lip.
It was the warden's car from the prison farm, he muttered. The one that's got the state seal painted on the side.
Sally Lou let out her breath with a loud whoosh. The prison farm car? Lizzie felt completely confused. Why would anybody at the prison farm want to kill Mr. Whitworth? But maybe... Could you see who was driving? She asked. Maybe the car was stolen, but that still didn't explain what happened. Freeman made a face.
Yeah, we could see. And no, it wasn't stolen. It was Jimmy Bragg behind the wheel. He drives that car all the time. Works for the warden as an assistant or something. Doobie and I know him from Pete's. He hangs out playing pool there.
Lizzie stared at him, beginning to understand just how serious this was for Freeman and Doobie. Jimmy Bragg was known around town as a troublemaker. Not very long ago, Archie Mann had asked Mr. Mosley to call Warden Burford to report that Bragg had started a fight that had resulted in some damage to merchandise in the back room at Mann's Mercantile. Even though the warden had made Bragg settle with Mann, he'd denied having any part in it. Just as he was likely to deny this far more serious accusation. If he were indicted and the case went to court, Freeman and Doobie would be called as witnesses for the prosecution, and colored men as witnesses, colored men who had been drinking. Well, it wasn't hard to predict the outcome. It was no wonder that Freeman and Doobie had decided they didn't want to get involved. Sally Lou was obviously thinking the same thing.
You're sure it was deliberate, Freeman? She asked hopefully. It wasn't accidental-like. Maybe a little game that got out of hand.
Freeman gave his sister a long look.
What you want me to say, Sally Lou? He asked thinly. Jimmy Bragg, he hit that car twice. Then he drove off without stopping to see what he'd done or how bad Mr. Whitworth was hurt. Even if it was some kind of game, it was wrong.
He hunched his shoulders.
And now I'm the one who's in trouble. Me and Doobie both.
Lizzie understood how he felt and the jeopardy he was in, but she also knew what she had to do. Mr. Mosley will be back in town tomorrow, Freeman. I'm sure he'll be able to help. But in the meantime, we need to call Sheriff Norris. She stood. I'll do that right now. I'll ask him if he'll come over here and talk to you instead of you going to the office.
No!
Freeman cried, his voice anguished. He started to get up from his chair.
No, please.
Yes, Sally Lou said, clamping her hand on Freeman's arm and forcing him to sit back down.
You call the sheriff, Miss Lizzie. Me and Freeman will wait right here.
Chapter 21 The Sheriff Gets His Man, and Then He Doesn't. The day had been a long one, and it wasn't over yet. But the half-hour Sheriff Buddy Norris had spent with Freeman Hawkins in Liz Lacey's kitchen had given him the information he needed, as well as several very good cookies and a fine cup of coffee. And he felt better and wiser than he had all day. Now he knew who had caused Whitworth's wreck and how. And he had the word of an eyewitness, and perhaps two, if Doobie Jenkins agreed to testify to what he had seen. There were still some things Buddy didn't know, though. He could not for the life of him figure out how Liz Lacey had managed to persuade Freeman Hawkins to speak up, especially since Hawkins had nothing to gain and plenty to lose by helping the police. Most colored folks weren't willing to come forward and say what they'd seen for fear of being called as a witness and afterward threatened, or worse, by friends of the accused. Buddy didn't blame them for being afraid. If he was colored, he'd be scared too. But however Miss Lacey had managed to pull it off, Buddy was grateful to her for convincing Hawkins to tell what he had seen. His reluctant story, which certainly had the ring of truth, explained what had happened on Spook Hill. But even when Buddy put Hawkins' story together with what he had learned from Mrs. Whitworth and Bodine Pyle, the why of it still eluded him. He could see several possible explanations branching out in several different directions, but if they made sense at some point, it was beyond his immediate understanding. When it came to motive, he was baffled. And when he left Liz Lacey's house, his relief at knowing who was darkened by the twin shadows of why and what next. Buddy was not in the mood for doing what came next. It was the part of the job he liked least. Thinking about that without enthusiasm, he drove back to the sheriff's office and went inside. He found Wayne, who was a serious reader, deep in the pages of an old issue of Popular Science, with Zane Grey's Sunset Pass at his elbow. Buddy hadn't read the Western, but he and Bettina had gone to see the movie, which starred Randolph Scott and Tom Keene, when it came to the palace. Tonight, he wished he was as good with a gun as Randolph Scott. "Get your weapon, Wayne," he said with resignation. "We're going out to the prison farm on this Whitworth business, and I don't know what kind of a situation we'll walk into." "Oh, yeah?" The deputy shot him a surprised look and then glanced up at the clock. It was nearly 9. "Yeah, and bring the cuffs. We'll likely need them." Wayne closed his magazine. "So, I guess you figured out who done it." "Tell you on the way," Buddy said tersely. But before they went out to the prison farm, they had to stop at Jed Snow's house. Jed was a justice of the peace and could give them the warrant that would allow them to examine the car Freeman Hawkins claimed to have seen and seize it if they wanted to. Under ordinary circumstances, Buddy might not have bothered with the warrant. But in this case, they were dealing with the warden of the prison farm, who might not take kindly to yielding up a state car. Buddy didn't ask Jed for an arrest warrant, though. He wanted to hear what Bragg had to say for himself first, and get a sense of whether he was telling the truth. If he figured he had probable cause after that, well, he could arrest him then. The Jericho State Prison Farm had been where it was since Buddy was a boy. Its main buildings clustered in a compound behind an intimidating 7-foot fence that was topped with barbed wire. Its nearly 1,500 acres of open pastures and farm fields spread out far beyond to the Alabama River on the west and Briar Swamp on the south, both significant barriers in case a prisoner took it in his head to try to escape. Most preferred a bed, meals, and a roof to gators and copperheads. Like other prison farms across the country, Jericho was designed to be self-supporting. That is, the 300 or so inmates were supposed to produce enough food, vegetables, meat, milk, eggs, to feed themselves and their keepers. They also baked their own bread, cooked their own meals, operated their own laundry, produced their own clothing, built their own buildings, and repaired and maintained their own vehicles. They even ran their own sawmill. The only thing they didn't make, Buddy thought with some irony, was their own booze. That they were buying from Bodine Pyle. But prison farms weren't judged on their self-sufficiency alone. They were expected to turn a profit, the bigger the better, and Jericho had long had the reputation of being the most profitable in the entire Alabama system. Lumber, corn, sorghum, cotton, cattle, pigs, and even chickens were substantial cash crops, and the profit they earned was returned to the state, minus the bonus paid to the warden for productivity and efficiency. The inmates, too, were a source of profit, for they were hired out as farm workers and lumberjacks and on road gangs. Warden Burford, who had been in charge of Jericho for over a decade, regularly won the state award for operating the most profitable prison in the entire state. Every November, he went up to Montgomery to collect his trophy at the big banquet, and Charlie Dickens always ran his picture on the dispatch front page. It was full dark by the time Buddy and Wayne drove up to the compound gate, a short distance off the Jericho Road. To the south, ominous flickers of lightning lit the sagging belly of a thundercloud, and an erratic breeze stirred the grass and trees along the road. Buddy hoped they could get their business done and get their suspect back to town before the storm hit. Late as it was, he worried that they might have some trouble getting into the prison compound, since the front gate was usually locked at dark. But to his surprise, there was a uniformed guard in the kiosk, and when he saw the sheriff's star on the side of the Ford, he hurried to open the gate. Buddy recognized the guard, a heavy-set guy named Leonard, whom he remembered as a skinny, pockmarked senior who was the star forward on the Darling High School basketball team when Buddy was a freshman. Now he looked like he'd keel over if he had to run more than 20 paces. The guard lumbered up to the car, and Buddy rolled down the window.
"Wasn't expecting you so quick, Sheriff," Leonard said. "How in the hell did you do it?"
"Do what?" Buddy asked.
"Why, get here so fast. Couldn't have been more than 12-15 minutes ago that the warden called your office."
Leonard shook his head admiringly.
"Reckon you've more under that hood than old Henry Ford put there."
He grinned.
"Take me for a ride sometime, huh? Show me what that car can do."
"Ah," Buddy said, understanding. But he'd just as soon nobody knew what he'd put under the hood. If he had to go after somebody fast, he wanted it to be a surprise. He said,
"We were probably better than halfway out here when the warden put in that call."
He paused. The prison farm usually took care of its problems on its own. He couldn't remember a time when the warden had telephoned the sheriff's office.
"What was Burford calling about?"
"Dunno,"
Leonard said.
"All I heard was that somebody got shot. Anyway, he'll tell you about it. I reckon you better go on over there."
Wayne leaned forward.
"Over where?"
he asked. Leonard stepped back, pointing.
"Try the warden's office first. If he ain't there, somebody can tell you where he is. 50 yards down this road, second building on your right."
He added,
"Don't park in the warden's space. Good way to get your tail kicked."
"Thanks," Buddy said, and shifted into gear. The prison offices were in the middle building in a row of wood-frame single-story buildings on one side of a neatly mowed grassy quadrangle. Other buildings, all painted the same drab green with brown trim, housed the mess hall and kitchen, a hospital and dispensary, and prisoners' barracks segregated by race, with additional separate barracks for white and black trustees. On the opposite side of the quad were sheds for shops, equipment repair, and maintenance. Floodlights cast a pale light over the grassy space and along the perimeter fence. Buddy pulled up and parked on the gravel apron in front of the office building, careful to avoid the space designated as the warden's with a wooden sign. Most of the windows were dark, but there was a bare bulb over the main door and lights on in a couple of the windows nearest the door.
"What's the plan?" Wayne asked.
Buddy had been puzzling over that, but he still hadn't come up with anything.
"Don't have one, exactly," he said. "I figure we'll just tell the warden what we've got on Bragg, and that we're fixing to impound the car he was driving last night and take him into town for questioning. I reckon we'll also have to deal with whatever it was he called us about."
Which Buddy still didn't understand. The prison farm had its own justice system. What was important enough to call out the sheriff after 9 on a weekday night?
"What if he won't give Bragg up?" Wayne asked. "Or refuses to let us have that car?"
Buddy didn't like either question very much, especially when he remembered what Bodine had said about Bragg being the warden's fair-haired boy. He sighed.
Well, the warden's a law enforcement officer just like you and me. What goes on out here is his business, and he can handle it pretty much any way he sees fit. But what happened on Spook Hill is in our jurisdiction, and a man was killed, a citizen of Darling. Bragg may be a state employee, but that doesn't exempt him from being questioned, or from being arrested and charged, if we figure we've got cause, or from being indicted and tried and convicted. Which was true, although it didn't exactly answer Wayne's question.
I get that.
Wayne's voice was hard and flat. But this isn't friendly territory, you know. There are folks out here who don't have a lot of good feeling toward the law.
I know, Buddy said, and sighed again.
He opened the car door.
Let's go.
The building's front door opened into a small lobby and then intersected with a hall, recently painted a particularly bilious color of green that ran the length of the building. Under the smell of fresh paint and turpentine, Buddy caught the smell of mold and damp wood. As close to the river and the swamp as these buildings were, it was a challenge to keep them from rotting, he reckoned. A sign on the wall announced the warden's office, with an arrow pointing to the right. Leading the way, Buddy went down the hall in that direction. His revolver felt heavy and uncomfortable on his hip, and he was more than usually aware of the badge on his shirt. Wayne was right. They were in hostile territory, where not even the guards could be counted on for help if they needed it. He was glad for his deputy, a couple of steps behind him. But it was moments like this when he wished he'd been smart enough to look for some other line of work. The door to the warden's outer office was open, and two uniformed guards and a couple of trustees were standing around, talking. They turned when Buddy and Wayne came in, and one of the guards, an overweight, balding man with a scar across his chin, came forward. His badge identified him as Lamar Puckett.
"Hey, Sheriff, kind of surprised to see you," he said, thrusting a fat hand forward. "That girl just called back and said she couldn't find you. How'd you get the word?"
Buddy shook his hand. "What girl?" He nodded toward Wayne. "This is Deputy Springer."
"Good to meet you, Springer." The guard shook the deputy's hand. "You know, the girl who runs the exchange," he said, turning back to Buddy. "The pretty one, Violet. When nobody answered at your office, she said she'd try to track you down and get a message to you. Where'd she locate you?"
"She didn't," Buddy said, not bothering to explain.
"Where's the warden?"
"At the hospital," Puckett said.
"With the body. Come on. He told me to take you over there when you showed up."
"The body?"
Wayne asked curiously.
"You got somebody dead?"
"Yeah."
Puckett showed a toothy grin.
"You know how it goes. The boys get mad, get in fights, cut each other up, or sometimes they kill themselves one way or another. Tell you the truth, I was kind of surprised that the warden called you about it, but I guess since he wasn't a prisoner..."
He broke off, making a motion with his head.
"Come on, let's get on over there before it rains."
Wayne gave Buddy an eyebrows-up glance, but Buddy shook his head. They'd go along with whatever was happening until it played out, and then they'd tell the warden that they were looking for Bragg. It wasn't raining yet, but the lightning was flickering with greater intensity. Thunder was rumbling to the south, and the wind had picked up. The prison hospital was 40 yards away, a narrow building with a door at either end and bars over the windows. Inside, the hallway was dimly lit by a couple of bulbs hanging from the ceiling. 10 yards down the hall, Warden Burford was standing in front of a closed door, talking to a uniformed guard. A large black dog with muscular shoulders, restrained by a leash and a heavy choker chain collar, stood at his knee. The warden turned when he saw Buddy and Wayne and stepped forward. The dog growled, low in its throat.
"Sheriff Norris,"
he exclaimed, his round face beaming.
"So the girl at the exchange was able to locate you. Good of you to come all the way out here so late. Thank you."
Buddy started to explain, but the warden didn't give him a chance.
"I thought you'd prefer to see for yourself what's